Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
Well, how do you get a good night's sleep? And how many hours of sleep do you need to feel refreshed in the morning? Some of us just need 6 hours and we're ready to go. Others need longer, between 7 and 9. And then we all know that the person who boasts about only needing 4 hours of sleep a night, well, yeah, I've never been very impressed with that. I wonder about you. This is what the science says. The amount of sleep you need depends on your age, with teenagers needing more shut-eye than adults. So when we complain about teenagers needing to lie in bed, it's not because of moral failing, apparently. The guidelines for teenagers, 8 to 10 hours. 18 to 64-year-olds need 7 to 9 hours. If you're 65 plus, 7 to 8 hours. And many of you will know the effects of not getting enough sleep, your inability to stay focused, irritability, memory lapses, impaired communication, diminished reaction times. According to a 2018 study published by Oxford University Press in the journal Sleep, insufficient sleep cost the Australian economy $17.8 billion. Well, if you've got a question about sleep, I'd love for you to talk tonight. And I don't want to hear from you just if you're a non-sleeper. We also love solutions here on Nightlife. If you've mastered the art of a perfect night's sleep, give us a call. Is it a tidy room, regular exercise, hot milk, meditation, chamomile tea? Open to all of that. Joining us tonight, first up, is Professor David Hillman. He's founding chair of the Australian Sleep Health Foundation. David, good evening. Welcome to Nightlife.
Well, thanks for having us aboard.
Well, terrific to have you. Are you a good sleeper?
I think I am pretty good at it, Phil. I think as I've got older, it's become a little bit less continuous. But no, I regard myself as a fairly good sleeper. I think as best I can, I try to obey a few basic rules, like making enough time for sleep and sleeping for regular hours. Also, fairly careful, and these are the sort of this is the general sleep hygiene advice I give to other people. But fairly careful to not have too many distractions in the bedroom, to wind down a little bit before sleep, and have a quiet, dark, comfortable bedroom. I think those are a few good starts to good sleep. And if you do that, then you're partly on the way. And it's remarkable to me as a sleep clinician how mean people can be about their sleep circumstances and actually not do some of the basics correctly.
So yeah.
Getting the basics right is important.
Why? I mean, I think this is a very difficult question, isn't it? Why do we need to sleep anyway?
Yeah, it is a difficult question, but all mammals do it. And, of course, what's happening during sleep is, what's happening during wakefulness as the hours go by is that all these neural circuits that you're using are running out of steam. They go through a process of down-regulation, so there's got to be a bit more chemical release at the end of each little nerve to get the same response the other side of the gap that the nerve signals travel. And also, as this is happening, there's a build-up of metabolites in your brain. There's a chemical called adenosine, which is a sort of a byproduct of energy used by the brain. That starts to build, and that's inhibitory in its own effect. That kind of has a dampening effect on brain function. It's kind of interesting that one of the competitors for their sort of little receptors that adenosine locks onto is caffeine. So one of the reasons why caffeine works for you in putting off some of the sleepiness signals is because it's kind of knocked adenosine off the place that'd be resting in your brain, and so there's less sleepiness as a result. The other thing that's happening during sleep is that it's not as though the brain is quiescent, it's quite active in other ways, and a lot of that activity has to do with memory consolidation. So putting together the information we gathered from the day before, forming it up into neat order, getting rid of redundant information, and of course the searing memories may remain, but a lot of information gets dismissed. So if you dream overnight, that's a kind of outward manifestation of your brain at work doing this sort of thing.
Yes, I wonder why it doesn't file a lot of things properly so you can remember them. But David, I suppose that's another matter.
Well, it may be a related point, Phil, because I think some people just simply don't let their brain sleep for long enough for that process to occur. It's always struck me as a bit of an irony. As a university student, you cram away and deny yourself sleep. And, of course, deny yourself the possibilities that your brain might consolidate the memory better if you did.
Yeah. I mentioned that figure in the intro from 2018. There was something like $17.8 billion lost from the Australian economy because of insufficient sleep, because of impaired performance and so on. Do we know whether our quality of sleep has reduced in the last 30 or 40 years?
Well, the Sleep Health Foundation's done two surveys, one in 2010 and the other in 2016. And there's certainly deterioration between those two times. I think it's it was an interesting time to have done the two surveys because it's a time where electronic media use has exploded. So it's kind of interesting. Back in 2010, about 35% of people complained of waking unrefreshed. That had gone up to 45% in 2016. What was interesting is that in fact, where it was a fairly evenly spread, this waking unrefreshed complaint across the age groups, adult age groups in 2010, there's a real bubble of problems in the 18 to 24-year-olds, who are, of course, the great electronic media users of all of us. So I think that the pressure on sleep from all these other tempting activities has got greater in recent years, and it all started with electric light over a century ago. Television did its own magic to sleep. Now other electronic media. And sleep's kind of been squeezed in by all of that.
And so yeah, well, I guess that's right. I mean, electric light's not that old, is it? I mean, it was really the turn of the last century that electric light becomes commonplace, and probably not for a few decades later that it became absolutely commonplace. So that therefore people were tending to probably go to bed earlier and wake up earlier. Is there any evidence that going to sleep more in tune with the sun, as it were, makes you sleep better?
Yeah, look, there are two big drivers to sleep, two rhythms in your body. One driver is time spent awake. So the longer you're awake, the more sleepy you feel. That's the so-called homeostatic drive. But on top of that sits your body clock, which is tuned to be sleepy during darkness and wakeful during light. So light and dark can certainly have major influences on the degree of sleepiness you feel. And light and dark can be used in a therapeutic sense to help. So people that, for instance, who are late risers and need to get to work a bit earlier, getting out in the sunlight in the early part of the day is a good idea. Whereas other people who tend to be too larkish in their habits, go to bed too early, wake up too early, you can use light in the evenings, that is intense light, to shift the body clock around. So the body clock has a big influence.
Yeah, okay. So would it be better for us generally if we could try and fit our sleep around that? It's probably impossible for most of us, but you're saying it would be better.
I think there's no doubt it's better not to have your sleep rhythms thrown out too much. 16% of Australians are shift workers.
Yeah.
And the accident rate, the workplace accident rate amongst shift workers is double that of other workers in the community. So that's a little bit of evidence just to suggest it's a bit of a problem, really. So even well-adapted shift workers, never completely adapt to the fact that they're working during the dark and awake during the light.
No, well, tell me about
that. Some people are very good at it and can do it easily. Other people are tempted into it because there's money there. I mean, the mining industry in Western Australia, I saw a lot of this. People are just physiologically unsuited to shift work, trying to do it and having problems as a result, right up to having haul pack crashes and things at the mine site.
Yeah. Yeah.
Having to give it away because they just simply couldn't handle it.
Yep. All right. I'm talking with Professor David Hillman. He's the founding chair of the Australian Sleep Health Foundation. And we're talking about sleep and strategies for getting a good sleep and questions about sleep too. If you've got some, 1-300-800-222 is the number. Michael on the Humes given us a call. G'day, Michael.
Hello, how are you going? I'm a shift worker, so I've recently started driving, and I finish at 4 in the morning, and I do that 3 nights a week, and I'm just wondering if I should get into a regular pattern. I'm just having trouble adapting to it. Just wondering if you have any strategies or tips, please.
Yeah, look, David? Really, with shift work, you've got to be pretty disciplined about time off duty, and of course the shift schedule itself shouldn't push the margins too much. But having a regular sleep routine during the daytime, making sure that you've got your bedroom set up in a way that that is conducive to sleep. So good light exclusion, good sound exclusion, and a bit of discipline in the rest of the household. You're at home, but you're actually there preparing for the next night on duty. And so getting your routines right, I think it's sounds like it's early days in your shift work career. And if so, then you've got a little bit of learning to do yet, and you'll do that. And it remains to be seen whether you're suited to this sort of work for the long term or not.
Okay. Righto, Michael. Thank you. A couple of texts on melatonin, David. Sophie in Perth says, it doesn't work for everyone, but prescription melatonin changed my life. It may help others.
Yeah.
And another text saying, I've heard of people using melatonin tablets to help children with getting to sleep. Is that bad? Says Julian Coburg.
Yeah. Well, melatonin is a prescription item in Australia, but it's kind of like a health food in the US. So it's a fairly benign medication, and it's certainly helpful for things like we were just talking about, shift work, just a disorder, for instance, and shifting your time zone around a little bit. Melatonin can help. So it can help you if you want to get to sleep earlier and wake up earlier, then taking melatonin in the evening can help with that. As a sedative, it's not particularly strong. Doesn't have very strong sleep causing properties in its own right, but it can help you place your sleep in the right place for you. And so if you're one of those people that has difficulty getting to sleep at a reasonable hour at night time, then melatonin can be helpful in bringing your desire for sleep forward. So instead of wanting to sleep in a kind of window between 2 a.m. and 10 a.m, you can use melatonin to help bring that sleep window back towards the 10 p.m.
Well, what's it doing? How does melatonin work?
Well, melatonin is really the hormone of sleep, and so this day-night sleep rhythm overnight, if you measure your own melatonin levels, they go up during the dark and down during the light. So it helps entrain the brain into this. It helps entrain this rhythm. It's part of the underlying sort of tuning of the brain for sleep and wakefulness. And so it's quite an important sort of intrinsic control on your sleep patterns.
Yeah, okay. So in other words, if you want to use it, do so. It's not particularly dangerous or harmful, is it?
No. The thing is, get supplies from overseas, and it's quite legal for an individual to do that. But getting the supply locally is a matter of a prescription, unfortunately. And so, it has certainly got its place, and it's certainly used a fair bit in sleep medicine, and it's a helpful aid to sleep. And so, particularly for these problems of day-night rhythmicity, and so it's part of the armamentarium. But I think if you're having those sorts of difficulties, good idea to have a chat with your medical advisor about that and get some sort of first-hand advice about whether it's going to suit you. Certainly got a role out there.
Professor David Hillman's with us, founding chair of the Australian Sleep Health Foundation. We're talking about getting to sleep. Sophie in Perth also raises this issue about exercise, which I think is an interesting question too. Sophie says, in my humble opinion, exercise is not, it's good for many things, of course, but it's not good for sleep. See, some people say, oh, if you exercise a lot, you'd be exhausted, then you go to sleep. I myself don't find that. What's your opinion, David?
Yeah, look, I don't, with all of these things, of course, there's no one size fits all. But in general, the general advice for exercise is very good thing to do during the daytime. It's part of a healthy lifestyle.
Of course, a good thing in
producing a sort of dichotomy between being awake and active and in bed and asleep. And so I think it's helpful in that regard. I think that the issue that's probably against the negative is if you exercise too close to bedtime. So doing arousing things, things that really get your system going in the half hour to an hour before sleep is not a good idea. Better, I think, for most people to have a wind down over that half hour to hour before planned sleep time. And part of the wind down is to do something quiet rather than vigorous exercise. So I think exercise during the daytime is a great idea as part of a general fitness thing, and it's good for sleep. Exercise late in the evening, not so good.
Mm. Yep. All right. Dorothy from Rockhampton. Hi, Dorothy.
Evening, gentlemen.
Hello, Dorothy.
Hi, Dorothy.
If I have trouble going to sleep, or if I wake up through the night and can't go back to sleep, I get up and have a drink of warm milk, and I go to sleep practically straight away. And another thing, some people have trouble with what they call restless legs, you know, that keeps them awake too. And I rub my legs every night with vinegar before I go to bed, and that helps.
Yeah, good on you. Well, look, there's certainly milky drinks and cheese. They contain casein, and casein's got some sleep-inducing properties.
I thought cheese was a no-no before bed.
Yeah. So she's on the money with that.
Right.
Of course, what she's very wisely doing is avoiding caffeine and any of that. You know, caffeine late in the evening is an arousing sort of a chemical, and so but milky drinks are a good idea as long as you don't overdo it. Of course, you know, weight gain's not what you want to be doing.
Mm.
As far as restless legs are concerned, well, there's some leg restlessness is a common problem, particularly in the hours just after sleep onset, and tends to fade away by the early hours of the morning, most people. But about one in six of us have restless legs from time to time. About 2 to 3% of us, it's a really troublesome problem which requires some clinical information, which we might talk about a bit later on, Phil.
Mm. Yes, exactly. All right, just some more questions on the text lines here. One of my texters early on says, I have a specialist doctor that insists that sleep before midnight is superior. I'm cynical about this claim. Gee, we've all heard this one, haven't we? That the hours before midnight are worth twice the hours after midnight. Is there any actual truth to that?
I think that's shorthand for saying, you know, it's in the first part of sleep that you get your really deep sleep. And so sleep's not a kind of one uniform state all night long. It's really quite, you go from light to deep sleep, back to light sleep, and every hour or so you get a burst of dreaming sleep. Those bursts get longer and longer as the night goes by. And after the first 3 to 4 hours of sleep, the deep sleep's over. And so deep sleep's important, but all of it's important. So I'm not sure I hold with the first 2 or 3 hours being the most important, but they certainly are important, and they certainly have your deepest forms of sleep within them.
But back to the nub of the question, do you get better quality sleep before midnight than you do after?
Well, I think a lot of people find, and particularly as they get older, that that they have this problem where they get off to sleep and they sleep the first 3 to 4 hours quite soundly. So they're in this deep, relatively difficult to arouse from type form of sleep. And then the deep sleep remits, and then sleep becomes a little bit more discontinuous. So I think that's quite a common complaint in older people. But of course, if you stop your sleep after 3 to 4 hours and you didn't have any more, then you'd miss out on the rest of sleep, including a lot of rapid eye movement sleep. And it's during rapid eye movement sleep, that's the dreaming sleep. These cycles of dreaming sleep I refer to, you do dreaming, most of you are vivid dreaming, but that's where a lot of the memory lay down, consolidation of memory, emotional modulation occurs. So, you know, it's kind of one of those things where you really need it all if you can get it all. But deep sleep is certainly a very important component of it.
Sure. Okay. All right. Keith, hello.
Yeah, good evening. How are you?
Not bad. Thanks, Keith.
Yeah, I'm 55 and I've just, I've never worked night shift before. And I've just started working night shift since the beginning of the year. And I'm really struggling with sleeping through the day. And I don't want to take any sort of pharmaceutical or anything, so I've tried a few herbal things, but they don't seem to really help that much. Is there any answer for that?
I think how long is the run of nights before you have a break, Keith?
I do 4 or 5 nights, depending. So I get 2 or 3 nights off. I've always been a good sleeper. I've always been going to sleep, you know, 8:30, 9 o'clock, and always awake fairly early. But I'm really struggling with it.
Yeah, look, it's not an uncommon problem, and it's a matter of whether it's a surmountable one or not. You'll be the judge of that at the end of it all. Getting the bedroom arrangements right. There's no doubt shift workers carry a bit of sleep debt forward, you know, so that's quite common to have a series of 5-hour nights and then a catch up at the end of the shift. It's not desirable, but it's common enough. And some people can do that readily, others not. But one of the things that particularly if shift work's new to the household happens is that the respect for your need for sleep isn't there to the degree that it needs to be, so that, you know, other people in the household have their lives to get on with, and they get on with their lives, and your sleep suffers a bit. So I think I agree with your approach. That is to avoid. I think medications don't have a big role to play here. Melatonin doesn't work that quickly. You can try melatonin, but it doesn't work that quickly. That it shifts things around. Within a 5-day shift schedule.
I've been trying Valerian.
And make sure that your bedroom is set up as best it can be for sleep. And that, of course, during the daylight, that includes, apart from sound exclusion, good light exclusion. Now, you don't necessarily have to have heavy drapes for that. Get yourself an eye mask like Qantas give you for free and try that.
All right, then. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Keith. Bye-bye. 1-300-800-222. Mark, hello. Hi, Mark.
G'day. How you going?
Very well, thank you.
I just want to ask a bit of a scientific question.
Mm-hmm.
How does dreaming interact with the information cortex of your brain, like your entropic brain? And what is his opinion on how brain receptors interact whilst you're awake or asleep?
Yeah, look, they're good questions. And the answer is, you know, a lot of the sort of notions about dreaming are just that, notions, because it's very difficult to, you know, what is happening with dreaming is a question. I don't think there's a clear answer to it. I mean, what is understood about dreaming is that it's it's certainly a manifestation of a rapid eye movement sleep, most commonly. I mean, you can dream in other sleep states too, but most of your vivid and best organized dreaming is in rapid eye movement sleep. And the thought is that it's some sort of manifestation of the information churn happening in your brain as you're sleeping. This process I referred to a bit earlier on, which is really gathering all the experiences of the day and sorting them out. And so that those experiences get formed up into memory and into part of your data bank of experience, which you carry forward. A lot of the information gets cleared out And of course, some of the really searing, nasty things that happen or interesting things get laid down in memory forever. You can recall them for the rest of your life. And so it's a bit of a sorting out process. And that's a little bit analogous to a busy sale at a store. You know, if you don't clean up the shelves overnight, it'd be just total disorganization the following day. And so it is with our brains, getting things organized so that the next day you can make sense of what's coming in the next day and put that information again into its little into its proper areas overnight.
If it's okay, can I ask a supplementary question?
Yeah, yes, Mark.
Do you think that the one thing that I'm really interested in is how they're going to figure out quantum gravity, and it's really involved in entropy? How have you gone down the pathway of combining how quantum physics works in the way that the brain does?
No, I think you've got a little bit postgraduate there for me. I'm not sure I can make a kind of sensible comment about that, except to say that in many senses we're at the infancy of understanding sleep and the magical processes that go on there. But, you know, the easy to measure things have been measured. The fact there's activity there has only been known in the last 50 years or so. The fact that it's actually purposeful activity. You give somebody a puzzle to do during wakefulness, you do a functional MRI scan on their brain, and parts of the brain light up, you see the same parts of light during sleep. And it's kind of all this interesting information emerging. There's still a lot more to know.
Mm. Okay, all right, yes, Mark. Thank you, Mark. I was reading the other day that I think it was a comment by Richard Feynman. Feynman, isn't it? The quantum physicist, famous quantum physicist from California, who said, "Anyone who claims to understand quantum physics clearly does not understand quantum physics."
Yeah.
Anyway.
Thanks for that. That's helpful.
Anyway, 1-300-800-222 is the number. A couple of others. Is a nightcap any good? I mean, the traditional nightcap, the, you know, the glass of whiskey or any alcohol, I suppose, and is an alcoholic drink, not many alcoholic drinks, but is an alcoholic drink late at night a good idea or not?
Overall, not particularly, no. The thing about alcohol is it's certainly got some sedating effects, and it will help with sleep onset. But the sleep gets much more disrupted subsequently. Mm-hmm. And so when you wake up the next morning, you don't actually feel more refreshed on account of alcohol. You feel less refreshed on account of it. So no, alcohol before bed's not a good idea. Phil, I'm no wowser, but I can't invent a good reason for a nightcap. That's not to say people won't do it.
No, but, okay.
It's not. Right.
All right. Where else are we on the text lines here too? Oh, yes. Adrian says, "Hi, is there any truth that cannabis helps people sleep? I'm told this by my clients all the time."
Yeah, look, it's interesting. In fact, a group I'm a part of in Perth, we've been doing a little bit of research in this area, and there's certainly cannabis, you know, it's really in the family of cannabinoids is huge. Mm-hmm. And so the chemicals active in the brain, and amongst those cannabinoids are some really interesting chemicals that hold a lot of promise as sedatives for the future. And so that remark doesn't surprise me. And I think it's very much a watch this space thing. I don't think it's a case of wouldn't dream of cannabinoids, they're drugs of addiction. It's much more a case of here's a really interesting family of drugs. It's possible, using the clever techniques available to pharmaceutical companies, to separate out the various chemicals and find some with some really desirable properties. And it's just maybe that we'll be able to put them to work in the sleep area to some extent. Now, having said that, Phil, I think it's important to note that all the sedatives we have today are really only suitable for short-term use. And they certainly have a role in that area, for instance, after with a bereavement or some upset. You know, long-term sedatives, all the ones we have today, and cannabinoids just may offer something different, But all the ones we have today have their habit-forming sorts of side, and as they get, as you form habits with them, they get less and less effective. You need more and more, and if you try to stop them, then the sleep becomes temporarily more disrupted. So there's not a lot to be said for them in the long term.
Mm. Okay, so sleeping pills as a habit are no good. I think we generally know that. Rod from Tamworth, does having the radio.
Yeah, although it's moving space, I think, Bill. You know, just might be that today the sedatives have really what they've done is hyped up the inhibitory parts of the brain. And there's one or two out there that are dampening down the excitatory parts of the brain, so going at the problem completely differently. So it might be that we develop a different view of them in the years to come, but the current situation is as you call it.
Okay. Anne from Thirroul says, I'm a 63-year-old female. For the last 6 to 8 months, I've started waking every 2 hours. I have no trouble getting to sleep, but the disturbed sleep is exhausting. I do go back to sleep, but I don't drink caffeine after 2 p.m. I stop exposure to screens a couple of hours before bed. I've tried a prescribed dose of melatonin, but no success. I've also tried valerian. Not keen to take sleeping pills. Otherwise, I'm healthy and exercise regularly.
Yeah,
any suggestions? Well, gee, Anne, I would think that a lot of people in your age group would report similar things. Why is that when we get older, David? A lot of people find that they can go to sleep easily, but then wake up.
Yeah, look, I think, again, sleep does get a little bit more tenuous with older age. And of course, accepting a certain amount of sleep disruption is good. It's really counterproductive. It's one of the dangers of having chats like we're having right now is you don't want to feed people's anxiety about sleep. Because you know, people will often misjudge how much sleep they're actually getting, you know, and they're actually getting enough, but it's just doesn't feel quite like it did earlier. But if you're waking up every 2 hours, you know, it starts making me wonder, and you're doing everything else right, then it's maybe worth getting a bit of advice about that, because it's no doubt that amongst all the problems with sleep disorders themselves get more common as you get older. So, and I'm thinking about conditions like sleep apnea here, which can present in all sorts of different ways. Usually it's snoring and the partner notices some obstructions to the breathing and waking up unrefreshed. That's pretty easy to diagnose. But it comes in more subtle forms where snoring isn't a particular feature, for example. But waking up overnight for reasons that can't otherwise be explained it may be a leading feature. So I think that if you're having problems and you just can't kind of figure it out yourself, go and get some advice. That's easy enough to diagnose.
Okay. Professor David Hillman's my guest, a founding chair of the Australian Sleep Health Foundation, and we're talking about how to get a good night's sleep. Back to some calls. G'day, Bob.
Bob from WA.
Hi, Bob.
Yep. Hi, Fred. I just want to know what you do about getting to sleep. My mother, I'm just wondering if there's some genetic carryover. My mother used to have awful trouble getting to sleep, and I find now that I've always had trouble getting to sleep, and as I get older, and I'm 92 now, I find I come to bed at 8 o'clock, I'm still awake at 4 o'clock in the morning. I come to bed at 10 o'clock, I'm still awake at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. I come to bed at midnight, I'm trying all these sort of things to try to get to sleep, and I can't get to sleep.
When you get to sleep, Bob, do you sleep okay?
The lady did take some more milk and come back. I hope that I'll get off for a while anyway.
When you get to sleep, Bob, do you sleep okay then?
No, I don't.
Right.
No, I might get to sleep till 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. I'm awake again at 7 or 8 o'clock. I'm ready to get up. So I've got to the stage now where I think, well, there's no use laying here any longer. I'll get up and I'll go for a walk. And that even becomes more difficult the older I get because of the bones aren't the same. But if there's some sort of genetic pass down through your mother?
David?
Well, you know, that certainly sleep can have some familial sorts of properties. But, you know, beginning, it's why you're having difficulty getting to sleep. Now, some people say, well, look, I just don't know. I'm quite relaxed. But in others, the head will be full of thoughts or issues that have been stored up during the daytime first get thought about when the head hits the pillow. So having
that's
this wind-down routine.
Lying in bed with your brain not stopping.
Yeah, exactly. And so even having a kind of a formal wind down routine helps some people, getting out a notebook in the middle of the evening and working out, you know, day's activities, what you've done during the daytime, and what you're planning to do about the various issues that have come up tomorrow. So working out the plan rather than starting the plan when you get to sleep. So it's part of having a good wind down routine. Now, of course, other people will have difficulty getting off to sleep because as they're drifting off to sleep, their breathing's starting to obstruct. Again, I'm back into the sleep apnea world, and sleep apnea can certainly run in families. And so waking up with a choke, snort, grunt, grasp. And so a bit of a direct chat between you and your doctor about what the issues are with that sleep onset, is important. Another thing that can be really aggravating for some people in trying to get to sleep is leg restlessness. So restless legs, that again has a familial
sort of... I've been through that restless leg syndrome, yes.
Yeah, and so that's... And of course, as you get older, if you're a bit light on for iron levels, then that'll drive restless legs big time. And so,
I tried all those sort of things. I made sure I get vitamin D and make sure I get some time in the sun. But I get that way. I'm coming to bed at night time, and before I'm even in bed, I think to myself, am I going to sleep tonight? And that's straight away a recipe for not sleeping.
Of course, the anxiety,
And of course, the anxiety then becomes the issue. Anxiety has a two-way relationship with poor sleep. You know, if you're anxious, you sleep poorly. If you sleep poorly, anxiety levels go up. And so there's a few things to figure out there. And I think just because you're in your 90s doesn't mean that, you know, close attention can't be given to these things. So go and get a review, I think, and let's sort of work out why you're not getting to sleep. And work out whether there's some physical impediments that we can deal with that make the situation better for you.
Okay, Bob.
Certainly beyond that, other simple things that can be done in this space, a whole lot of tools that clinical psychologists are very good at applying, that is relaxation techniques and mindfulness techniques, are used in the insomnia space a lot to great effect. So it doesn't have to be a sedative type solution. There's a lot that can be done.
Mm. All right, Bob, good luck with this. And thanks for the call too. 1-300-800-222, text 0467-922-702. More texts. Jan from Mollymook says, Phil, what about paracetamol? I find it helpful sometimes to help me sleep. I wonder what your guest thinks.
Yeah, I wonder. Paracetamol doesn't have any formal sleep-related advantages that I'm aware of. But of course, if you have this body that's getting a bit older and you have aches and pains, certainly pain's a great disturber of sleep. And again, rather like anxiety, there's a bi-directional or two-way relationship there. If you have body aches and pains or pain of any kind, then that'll disturb sleep. And so dealing with the pain helps. And equally well, disturbed sleep decreases your pain thresholds for all sorts of stimuli. So having poor sleep is bad for pain. Having pain is bad for sleep. And so I wonder if the a few little body aches and pains that are settled by the paracetamol and the sleep's better, that would be a good explanation for that beneficial effect you're getting. And, of course... I think paracetamol, one or two, you've got to watch the total quantities over 24 hours, one or two before bed is a pretty low-risk sort of strategy. So I'm pleased it's working for you.
Okay. All right, 1-300-800-222. Back to some calls. Matt, you've been waiting on there. Sorry, Matt.
How you going, guys?
Not bad.
I've been shift working for quite some time. I think the major thing is... you've got to have the right environment. So your room needs to be pitch black if you're sleeping during the day. Like, I've got Corfluid set up on the windows. It's white to reflect the sunlight, and then it's got a layer of black behind it, which blacks the room out completely. I can close the door during the day, and I've got to turn a light on in the room, or else I can't see my hand in front of my face. That's the light sorted out. Now the temperature. You've got to have between 22 and 24 degrees. If you like it colder, go colder. Like it hotter, go hotter. I've also found turning the internet off really, really helps an hour before bed. And I also use something called blue light blockers. I'll turn the TV off and I'll read for an hour with those on. And I go to sleep every night. Like, I'll do shift work when I'm working, then come home and then sleep during the night. Never a problem. But yeah, just cut the caffeine out, drink lots of water, try meditation and relaxation, and yeah, the mindfulness like the professor suggested. But apart from that, yeah, I don't have any problems getting to sleep. I'm 51, I'm not the fittest person in the world, but then yeah, I don't, you know, I flip from time zone to time zone, so I go night shift to day shift.
Good on you, good on you, Matt. Yeah, probably, you'd probably like that, all that information and those suggestions, David. Would you?
I think they're great, Matt, and I think you're really on the money there. I mean, Matt's been doing it for a while. He's good at it, but he doesn't. It's not an automatic. He's actually, Matt, taking some really sensible steps to manage his daytime sleep, and he's into this keeping the light out. Very good idea. Keeping the temperature right, and of course, during summer, that's an issue to be managed, getting that temperature. And I think that depends on how much bedclothes you use, but 18 to 19 degrees with is perfect with some bed covers on, and higher temperature with less bedclothes on. And of course, these other routines he does, that is... getting the electronic media out of there in the hour before sleep and getting himself properly prepared is good. So he's got a routine. It's working for him, and those are good tips for to be followed generally, I think.
Yeah. Yes, I think the darkness is a very important thing too. You've got to have a room that's dark if you're going to have a sleep.
You really do, don't you?
I do. I use a sleep mask as well. Some people can't use those because they find them too uncomfortable. I mean, I'm okay with them, but...
Yeah, and so am I. And, of course, they're very cheap, a lot cheaper than getting expensive drapes. But if you're into expensive drapes, there it is. You know, in Scandinavia and in those sorts of northern European countries where during their summer they have 24-hour light, you know... In the far north, and they get this what's called seasonal affective disorder because it interrupts with it really plays some havoc with their sleep. So seasonal affective disorder being a sort of depression secondary to lack of sleep.
Okay, Murray, hello.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Hi.
How are you?
Well.
Good. My teenage daughter and I were catching a train back from Melbourne to Bendigo, about a two-hour train ride, and she fell asleep for all intents and purposes with her head against the train window, but with her eyes almost fully open. And I realised that she was a bit spaced out, and I put my hand in front of her and sort of moved my hand backwards and forwards. No response. And she was still breathing and everything, so I wasn't too concerned about it. And then after a couple of minutes, she came to, like, snapped out of it, and I said, "What were you doing?" She said, "I was asleep." And I've never seen anything like it in my life. It was bizarre.
Well, is that possible, David? Can you sleep with your eyes open?
I think if you're very sleep-deprived, you can do all sorts of unusual things.
Wild West gunfighters used to sleep with one eye open. I know that.
Yeah, and of course, some mammals sleep with half their brain going while the other half sleeps. So it's kind of, and of course, people, particularly very sleep deprived people, are capable of quite complex activities asleep, driving, even driving cars. But the story of armies marching asleep is well documented. So it's possible to have for such phenomena to occur, but of course, one thought that just goes across my mind, probably to be dismissed, I would think, Murray. But epilepsy is something that just one has to kind of just have in the back of the mind. So it might be worth just following this episode through a little bit and just making sure that that there's nothing else there. But I think particularly if you were coming back and you were extremely short on sleep at the time, then it may be possible just to accept this as a kind of unusual manifestation of sleep.
Yes. Okay.
It was a couple of years ago, and she certainly hasn't done it since. And being a teenager, she has her phone in her room against our wishes, but she was probably sleep deprived. But she certainly came back from somewhere else when she woke up, and she wasn't distressed at all. She just
interesting. Yeah,
and
yeah.
quite lucid when she woke, and so it does make the possibility I've just thought about unlikely. And I think the 2 years of no issues since make it more unlikely still. All the same, you know, it's just a kind of thought.
What about before we go, David? What about napping during the day? Is this a good idea or a bad idea?
Look, napping, I think prolonged sort of undisciplined naps are not a good idea because it kind of interrupts with the sleep overnight. And so if you want to consolidate sleep overnight, you nap during the daytime, you're less likely to get it. There is a limit to the amount of sleep the brain requires, and we get some nap during the daytime, it detracts from sleep overnight. But a short nap in the hour or so after lunch, there's a little blip in your sleepiness scale at that point there. Probably if people do it and they enjoy it, there's no harm in it. But I think long naps to kind of make up for lousy sleep overnight are likely to perpetuate that lousy sleep overnight. So be careful about that.
Mm. Yes, all right. David, long-distance driver, hi.
G'day. I was just wondering, I'm looking at changing jobs. I've been driving interstate overnight 10 years. And I was wondering, how hard is it, or how long does it take to go back to sleeping during the nights?
I think that it's a little bit like jet lag. You can do it. It takes just a few days, not longer than that. If you're pretty disciplined about it, you know, that is, go to bed at a regular time, wake up at a regular time. Some people have to ease themselves back into it, but in general, I think you'll find it to be a fairly quick process, because even though you've been doing a lot of overnight stuff, no doubt as a result of your long distance driving, your basic day night light dark rhythm has been bowling along. Despite that, you've just been very good at controlling it. I think you'll find that you'll be able to get back into that normal rhythm within days and weeks, rather than longer than that.
Okay, because I was listening to some of your other people, and they're saying, "Oh yeah, they turn off the lights, do this, do that." I sleep at about 20 degrees. Make sure the lights are off. I actually have a fan on some days to create a white noise, so I don't actually hear other things, which I found to be good. Doing stuff like that, when I actually go back to sleeping at night, it'll still be all right.
Yep, definitely. And you'll get into that rhythm again. Reading between the lines, it sounds like you've got one of those brains which is quite good at moving around the body clock. Some brains are good at it. Some people are very good at shift work. Some brains are just not particularly good at it. And shift work's not for that sort of a brain, unfortunately. And we had a call there earlier on, I think, might have been Keith, I think, but who is experimenting with shift work in his 50s, and he's just finding it a bit difficult, and he's working out whether it's for him or not at the moment.
Mm. Okay, thanks, David. Good on you. Bye-bye. 1-300-800-222 is the number. Yeah, all right. Good mattresses are important. I think we've covered that. Sleep apnea machines, if you are snoring, do something about it. I think you'd agree with that, wouldn't you, David?
I think so. And of course, again, with sleep apnea, I find a lot of people avoid having their sleep apnea looked at because they're very worried they'll end up on one of them machines.
You know, yeah,
I've heard that often. And of course, amongst that group, there's a whole swag of people who just find the machine to be fantastic and life-changing. and so they deal with that thought sure. that way. But of course, there's not the only solution to sleep apnea.
No, that's an important. Yeah.
And so getting it looked at and knowing what you're dealing with is important.
Okay.
And it's very destructive on sleep, and there's lots can be done, including, among other things, dental appliances.
That's right.
Very good for snoring and milder forms of sleep apnea.
That's right. You don't always end up on the machine. Okay. All right, David. Time has beaten us, but thank you. There's a lot of useful and practical information there, and I do thank you for your time and expertise. Thank you.
Yeah, well, thanks, Phil, and it was great talking to your wonderful listeners.
Likewise. Professor David Hillman, Founding Chair of the Australian Sleep Health Foundation. Thanks for the texts and calls.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.